Doesn't feel quite as hot in here.
I'm going to call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this June 17th. And we're going to continue our informational hearing to open an informational hearing on CCOs. We have three CCOs with us today. This gives us a little flexibility on the time. And if you would call the first witness, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first up today is the Umpqua Health Alliance. Mr. Gary McCormick, CEO.
Welcome, Mr. McCormick. Thanks for coming up. If you would introduce yourself, please, when you start your testimony.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I'm Gary McCormick. I'm the interim CEO of Architrave Health, which is a parent organization to Umpqua Health Alliance. With me today is Brent Eichmann, who's our executive vice president. He's been with the company for 9 years, and hopefully collectively we can answer your questions that you may have about Umpqua Health Alliance. Sure. We do appreciate the opportunity to share with the committee how we're organized, a little bit about our financial performance over the last several years, and also to talk about some of the efforts we've made to improve the health delivery in our community, as well as improve the members' experience. We've provided a set of slides, and I'll try to cue them as we go along. In terms of a structure, prior to the creation of the CCOs, the Oregon Health Plan was held. Oregon Health Plan contract was held for a number of years by the Douglas County Independent Practice Association, or as we call it, DSIPA. With the advent of the CCOs, the name was changed to Umpqua Health Alliance to reflect the inclusion of other community members. The UH board now is comprised of representatives of ADAPT, which is a service that treats addiction and substance abuse, Advantage Dental, Architrave Health, Atrio Health Plans, which is a Medicare Advantage plan that has several thousand dual eligibles in it, DSIPA, Douglas County Commissioners, Greater Oregon Behavioral Health, Mercy Medical Center, Umpqua Community Health Center, and the Community Advisory Council. And the council is represented on the board through its chair. The council meets monthly, and it has quarterly meetings open to the public. In terms of financial performance, 2013 and 12 were relatively similar. We had net income of 6% and 5% respectively in those 2 years, with the enrollment increase of about 60%. And the increase in capitation rates for the expansion population, that net margin increased to 10% in 2014. However, we expect the claims experience associated with that newly enrolled population to increase as it matures. And as a result of this, we estimate that we will return approximately $9 million to the state in the form of taxes and a rebate. I think one of the more important outcomes of the formation of the CCOs has been the increased communication and collaboration among healthcare providers. While it's hard to quantify exactly what that means for our community, it has provided a platform for working together that previously didn't exist. A good example of this is community mental health. A little over a year ago, the county informed the UHA board as well as the community that it was getting out of the mental health business. And given the makeup of the UHA board, it provided an ideal forum to discuss the impact of that on the community and what alternatives existed to try to fill that void. We had discussions resulted that included GOBI and the DSIPA Management Services, and through pooling of their resources, we were able to stand up a new nonprofit called Community Health Alliance. With GOBI's guidance and DSIPA's management expertise, we developed a management service agreement that provided finance, accounting, HR, and billing services to the NUCO. I think the important message here is as we approach the first anniversary of that organization, it is The CHA is now providing most of those services in-house with a little bit of outside consulting, and it currently employs about 100 people. This is not to say that the startup was not without problems. We did have our growing pains, but it did get done. CHA is now exploring filling another need that exists in our community, and that is providing an alternative to ER use for members in crisis. They are currently developing a short-term stay or respite model for in a facility that used to house the behavioral health unit at Mercy Medical Center, and it stood vacant for a number of years. So that is one specific example of how these relationships matter. In addition, the concept of global budgets, risk-taking, and incentives have kind of sparked some lively discussion about alternative methods of delivering care in innovative ways in our community. Currently, the Umpqua Health Alliance serves about 29,000 members in Douglas County in a variety of settings. They include two federally qualified health care centers, one rural clinic, a number of patient-centered primary care homes, behavioral clinics, and addiction clinics. And on slide four, I'd like to share some of the statistics to provide a kind of a perspective of how we provide some of these services. 88% of our members are assigned to patient-centered primary care. Excuse me.
Just briefly, could you go back to the slide on, I'm trying to understand the nature of your organization when you talk about CHA in the middle of it, I've gotten lost. Could you go over that slide for us?
Which one was that?
It'd be the very first one, I think, though.
In terms of the structure of our organization?
Yes.
You see represented there, the parent is Architrave Health, which is a joint venture between DSIPA and Mercy Medical Center.
A profit-making?
Yes.
A profit organization. DSIPA and Mercy Medical. Mercy Medical is also a profit-making organization.
It is a nonprofit.
Nonprofit. And DSIPA is
an LLC.
Okay, go ahead. And then under that,
actually, I think DSIPA at that level is an incorporation. Is a corporation.
A straight C corp.
Right. So if you go down to DSIPA doing business as Umpqua Health Alliance, that is the organization that we're talking about. So it's a subsidiary of this joint venture.
And these others are—they're not subgroups of.
No, they're just illustrative of other aspects of the organization. We are in other lines of business in addition to the Oregon Health Plan. We operate a rural health clinic. We operate another medical clinic.
And the "we" in this case is
Architrave, the parent company.
I can see it.
And then we have some support services, like we have a billing service. We have an electronic medical record that's supported.
And CHA is on here somewhere?
CHA is listed on this part of the slide as DSIPA doing business as Umpqua Health Alliance.
So CHA is the same as Umpqua Health Alliance?
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say CHA? UHA. Umpqua Health Alliance.
I may have the terms mixed up. Talking about the mental
just
health
been
group.
Talking about
what's the name of the mental health group you were
Community
just
Health Alliance, which that's where the CHA comes from. So we're kind of fond of Alliance down there.
And where is that on this chart?
It's not on this chart. It is a nonprofit that is a standalone organization serving our community.
Which is the CCO in this?
Umpqua Health Alliance.
The Umpqua Health Alliance. That's not. I must be a little slow. Lunch must have made me.
I apologize for the lack of clarity in our presentation.
You have a chart here. A table of organization.
Yes.
That relates how to the CCO that you're reporting on today?
Well, I was trying to show the CCO's relationship to the rest of our organization. Why I'm sitting here as chair of Architrave giving a report for UHA.
And where on this chart is the CCO?
The CCO is listed as DSIPA LLC, doing business as Umpqua Health Alliance.
So when we're talking about the legal entity that's one of 16 CCOs, that's the DSIPA LLC, but it's also called something else.
It's doing business as Umpqua Health Alliance.
Does it do business as anything else?
No, it does not.
So that's essentially the Umpqua Health Alliance.
That is correct.
And that's in the middle of this larger... Yeah, so if you're, what would be useful to report on today is whatever is the CCO.
And that's what we're doing.
Okay. And on the table organization, it's this little box on the left.
Yes, that's correct.
It's not. So why did you give us the rest of this stuff?
I thought there might be a question about why I was here, the CEO of Architrave, giving this report.
I'm still having that question. Who's the CCO? Who's the CEO of the CCO?
There is not one.
The CCO doesn't have a...
Well, essentially, I fill that capacity through a management services agreement to the Umpqua Health Alliance.
All right, go ahead. I'll try and follow.
I'd be happy to provide further clarification in addition to the presentation if it would be helpful to the committee.
Only if you'd like us to understand anything.
I was describing our service provision. 88% of our members are assigned to patient-centered primary care homes. We, early on in this process, hired a support person to assist physicians in getting certification with the state. We pay an incentive for that based on the level obtained, and currently 87% of them are at Tier 3. 60% of our members are assigned to clinics with embedded mental health providers. 95% of our members are assigned to PCPs who use an electronic medical record. And 88% of those are assigned to PCPs who use UMCO OneChart. UMCO OneChart now includes chart notes for mental health practitioners so that there is an opportunity for better integration of physical health and mental health treatment plans. We are now moving into the area of population health management in terms of developing tools to support the decision process. And on slides 5, 6, and 7, I've given you some examples of some screenshots that describe some of those tools. We have run a pilot with a selected group of physicians and mid-levels who are, and we had a satisfactory result from that, and we're now seeking data sharing agreements that will allow us to populate this database with both claims data and billing data so that we'll have very timely reports. Additionally, I'm pleased to report that we were able to accommodate the expansion population in a very timely manner. We've accomplished this both by adding providers to existing clinics as well as expanding those hours. In our rural health clinic, for example, now we offer evening hours as well as Saturday appointments. And this success in recruiting has actually extended the community as a whole. Last year, it recruited 17 physicians and 11 mid-levels. On slide 9, gives a depiction of ranking of health status by county.
Can we go back? I'm going to get confused again. Can we go back to slide 5?
Yes.
The results you're presenting here. How many members totally do you have?
29,000.
All right. Will you take any one of these numbers and explain to me what the numerator and the denominator is?
This on the slide 5 is designed to assist the physician to see how he's doing in terms of meeting program metrics.
This is this doctor's report card.
This doctor's report.
I got it. It's not the total report card.
No.
Gotcha.
It's just for his enrolled population.
And does this show how many members this doctor has assigned to him?
Yes.
It has 544 in the upper right-hand corner.
So taking the colorectal screening, 14 out of 27, how does that relate to the 544?
Because not all of those patients would be of an age to have that as a requirement.
Only 27 patients out of 544 would be of that age. Is that what that would say?
That's the way I would interpret it. That portion of his panel should have colorectal screening. The second one, in terms of on slide six, really shows a gap list, the kinds of things he still has to do with respect to his patient panel. And slide seven shows how he compares to his peer group. Mm. Gives him kind of a snapshot about.
Will you be reporting those same tables for the whole population?
Yes. Okay. Would it be by, right.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
And back to community rankings. Unfortunately, Douglas County has traditionally ranked near the bottom of Oregon counties in terms of number of health measures like obesity, smoking, drug use, and longevity. This starting point poses a number of challenges and points to the need for further integrative efforts. And I'll give you examples of a few of those. In cooperation with the Umpqua Community Health Center, which is a FQHC, we help fund an expanded care clinic, and this clinic was designed to serve patients that have both SPMI and diabetes and who are using the ER as their primary support tool. And so they are now located in a clinic setting, and we have had a decrease in ED utilization associated with this move, but we kind of transferred high utilizers in the ER to high utilizers in the clinic setting. So the overall effect of this approach is still under review. We've developed a coordinated care team that is designed to assist patients that are discharged from the hospital ED or from the hospital itself who are in need of follow-up care. They are located close to the emergency department and have space to actually conduct face-to-face interviews or exam if necessary. And this approach has worked so well in terms of integrating them with the providers that we're now getting requests from other sources for helping place patients with immediate needs. We also have an interdisciplinary care team, which is kind of the team of last resort. Usually by the time that a patient gets here, they're known to the providers that populate this committee, and it serves as a way to further integrate their care into customized treatment plans. The success of these programs is all dependent on effective communication with members. And I think the enrollment process that we watched this year has demonstrated that this population may not respond to traditional means of communication, and even when it's in their best interest. So we have commissioned a firm to conduct focus group with our members to help determine the most effective way to communicate with them. And we're also exploring a smartphone app called PingMD. Currently, we're utilizing this with only a provider group to gain experience with it, but we think it has capabilities of providing a real communication tool with members on a real-time basis. In terms of ethnic diversity, we don't have a lot of that in Douglas County, and so we've kind of substituted economic diversity instead, specifically the culture of poverty. And we have sponsored several community-wide training sessions to improve the understandings of these issues. You also ask us for the three metrics where we're having the most difficulty, and those are listed on page 12. I guess the best thing we'd say is that we didn't go backwards, at least from year to year, but we haven't made a lot of progress as well. In terms of the adolescent well care visits, they're now flagged on our UMCA 1 chart so that the physicians is aware that they've not been done. They do show up on the gap list, and we're looking at a program to fund sports physicals for our members if, in fact, they include an SBRT evaluation as part of that process. As far as hospitalization following for mental illness, we've sometimes have interfaced with these patients on the day of discharge, and I understand that we're going to get credit for that in the future. We're also trying to develop better information sharing arrangements with GOBI for tracking their inpatients. And we're also looking at including CHA, which is our mental health provider, in non-emergent transportation because they do have a fleet of cars. And we're seeing this as if they could take the patient home from the hospital, that there may be an opportunity to develop a relationship there and some level of assessment about the patient's needs going forward. DH custody evaluations, it's a very small number, but it's an important segment. Our answer here is primarily trying to consolidate these into one type of Saturday clinic where we could accomplish the physical exam, a mental evaluation, and sealants all kind of in one stop. It's hard, even though we lack clarity in the beginning of this process, it's hard to kind of condense several years of work into a 20-minute presentation. But we feel that the movement towards CCOs was the right move, and we think with your continued support that better things are yet to come. And with that, we'll try to answer your questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any questions? Mr. Kenegar?
Thank you. I have three questions, so answer them in whatever order you want. One is I'd love an update on the Community Advisory Council. As I recall, we had some discussions about that a couple of years ago. I think this was the CCO in which you were not publicizing the names because of concern about a domestic violence. Someone was a domestic violence survivor. And so I'd love to hear an update on that. Also, Flex Services. I know the chair has been asking a lot about how you're using Flex Services. For instance, some are using gift cards to improve the well adolescent care. And thirdly, I just wanted to know how you're treating some chronic diseases like hepatitis C. I've heard that you're one of the few CCOs that is requiring, for instance, no smoking, which I applaud the idea of trying to get people not to smoke, but that if they're not quit smoking, that they don't have access. So if you could answer those, that'd be great.
Chair Greenleg, Representative Kittengeyer. In terms of the CAC meetings, they now are open to the public. I think you have a good memory. As I recall, there were some problems associated with people trying to promote specific causes at the public meetings.
We have that same problem.
Tended to be a little disruptive. We've had some local advocacy groups that have still pursued that course. We have adopted a code of conduct, and we're dealing with questions in a written format now, and that's kind of calmed things down a little bit. So we think we are meeting that visibility requirement now. With respect to the flexible spending accounts, they've primarily been to assist in, obesity management, some pain conditions that have been treated through exercise, those kinds of things. We do have a policy that was approved by the state to administer that program, and I think there's probably a learning experience in there somewhere. I know that we have to be judicious in the use of these funds as well as document that's an appropriate application. But at the same time, we've kind of created some hurdles in terms of the record-keeping requirements for demonstrating that they're appropriate. The third question was, I'm sorry.
Sovaldi, Hep C treatment.
I don't believe there's any smoking requirement, or cessation of smoking requirement for receiving that medication. We have had one Harwana case that we did appeal, but we're currently providing that service. We haven't had a lot of experience with that as far as, but we are concerned about the cost of the medications. In the one case that was appealed, essentially we're looking at a person with a compromised hepatic situation that we're looking at treatment costs around $133,000 for that patient.
I appreciate if you'd look into that and let us know if it really is a smoking cessation requirement.
Can I just do one follow-up on it? I'd be happy to send you the information that looks like it's part of your regulations, and I'll send it to you, too.
You could send it to him, and he could send it to us. Representative Lively?
Thank
if
you.
I can just figure out which box I'm in.
That's right. Chair Greenlink, I have a question about recruitment and that, but I want to ask just a question about the rebate and the finances, and so I appreciate the difference in the, quote, net income. And one of the things we've heard from other CCOs is because of the large number of patients that have come in late in the process, in many cases you haven't started to incur the full expense of that. So what I'm trying to understand, this rebate of $7.5 million versus how much is going to reserves in that in anticipation of costs that are going to be substantially higher than they've been in 2014, or is that, I guess I just don't understand the rebate part of it.
We understand that that we have to demonstrate a medical loss ratio, and those are funds that were below the medical loss ratio extrapolation. So essentially they're funds that we didn't use, and so they're coming back to the state.
But you've got reserves taken out.
We already have reserves set up for the level of business that we do, okay, you know, that are appropriate.
Sure. So the other question, so
and help I think there's some distinction there between nonprofits and for-profits, too. But in any event, we had a good experience, and we're returning some money to the fund.
Yeah. Thank you. So you're to be applauded, frankly, for your recruitment and retention, and so some areas aren't as successful when you talk about 17 new physicians in a year's time. So what do you attribute your success at recruiting new providers?
There's a couple of things that go into that. One of the things is that as a community, we've came together and decided where the levels of need are, and we identify recruiting targets for both primary care and specialty care. And then the community recruits towards those goals. And we're part of that effort. We both have needs to populate our own clinics, but we also support you know, physician recruitment that is not directly related to the health plan. And Mercy Medical Center also realizes that need. So I think it's because we're trying to coordinate that activity in a way that makes sense to the applicant and provide a good selling job when they're there.
Yeah, but that one. Thank you.
I'm going to go back to the table of organization, being an organization.
I was afraid of that.
Wait, what's the board of directors of the, of the CCO?
The board of directors for the CCO are listed on slide 2. That board meets on a monthly basis.
The board manages the CCO, is that right? Manages Umpqua Health Alliance.
Yes, some of the back office functions are still performed, you know, by the SIPA management, and you know the discussion about coordinating care incentives, how we work together, receiving information from the CAC on the Community Health Improvement Plan. All those things occur under the UHA board umbrella.
The SIPA is more than the Umpqua Health Alliance. It's a historic organization.
Yes, right. But it is not the box that we tried to describe before. Does nothing but health plan work.
The SIPA?
There are several.
Somewhere else so, as well, is that right? I mean, the SIPA has been there for a while.
The SIPA has been there for a while.
And it's still there in addition to being the Umpqua Health Alliance function, is that right?
Chair Greenlake, I hate to do this, but if we go back to the organization chart.
I've got it right in front of me.
If you look up in the upper left-hand corner, the SIP of the Douglas County Individual Practice Association, Inc., that is the half-owner to these other enterprises.
And one of the things that it half-owns is itself.
This guy is this guy.
Yeah. But it owns it. Well, it owns itself.
Different classification. It's not the owner.
In addition to owning itself, it owns half of the Umpqua Health Alliance, which is itself, right?
It does that as part of as a joint venture. You know, I thought an insurance company would have problems explaining their relationship to this, and I'm having a great deal more difficulty here. Maybe we do you have any clarifying wisdom?
Let me tell you why I'm leaning on this issue, because we're trying very hard to find out where the single source of responsibility is in the CCOs, and they are complex. HealthShare has Providence and Kaiser and all these people, and we can't figure out what the hell is in charge there. But I think it is important for us to have a clear-cut understanding of who's in charge of this. And rather than having a bunch of shells, you get to move around and look under, looking for who's in charge there. This seems not crystal clear. To me, and I've spent my life as an organizational theorist looking at organization charts, so they don't provide a mystery to me. They should be revealing. This one is a little less than revealing. And that may be fine. It's just life may really be as complex as it appears.
Chair Greenlake, I don't know if I can more effectively take any more of the committee's time.
I think we've had enough. I do appreciate that. I appreciate you coming up all the way. And for good works there. And keep it up.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being here. Would you please call the next group?
Next up is the Willamette Valley Community Health Plan, Bill Guest.
You didn't bring anybody to protect you?
You said solo. I try to follow your instructions.
I appreciate that.
I wish I had somebody here. I'll tell you why in a second. Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. For the record, my name is Bill Guest. I'm the executive director and CEO of Willamette Valley Community Health. And under the category as you didn't bill this, I've been here for 10 months. Prior to that, I was living happily in Klamath Falls. I helped manage. I was the CEO of the health plan in Klamath Falls. I came there in 96. They were a patient care organization at the time, no hospital or pharmacy risk. And after I was there, we became a fully capitated health plan, did that for 16 years. And then I was there for the transition to a CCO. And when my kids left and my grandkids moved up here, we followed them up here when we were asked to come up here. So we did that. So what I'm going to share with you is a lot of hard work done by other people. I will try to do it justice. It's a good plan here. Great to be here.
You feel free to take credit for anything that's good.
Okay. Our mission statement is on the next slide, and to improve the health status and outcomes for Marion and Polk residents. That's our service area, through promoting prevention and wellness in a system that is cost-effective and integrated and equitable. And this matches in line with the triple aim there. We are the ultimate entity, Willamette Valley Community Health, in charge of overseeing the regulatory requirements and goals of the CCOs there. The chart that shows board governance, we have 19 members. They're not all owners. We'll talk about owners in a second. And it comes from a wide variety of professionals and health providers. Two independent physicians. We have an independent physician association, which was the originating company that helped start the fully capitated health plan. A large clinic, two fully qualified, federally qualified health clinics, four hospitals, two independent physicians, two mental health providers, one public, one private, a a dental care organization, the chair of our community advisory council, and two public representatives, as well as the Medicare Advantage plan with whom we coordinate care for our dual eligibles. The second slide on governance just fills in a little bit more details exactly who those entities are. In regard to board ownership, we are comprised of 11 entities or owners. We ourselves are a limited liability corporation, not for-profit, taxable is the legal format. 9 out of the 11 of our owning entities are not for profits, and they include, they were described in the previous chart, Salem Health, Sandy Hospital, Silverton, West Valley Hospital in Polk County, Northwest Human Services, Yakima Valley Farm Workers, two physician organizations, the WVP Health Authority and the Salem Medical Foundation, Capital Dental, which is one of our four DCOs. It's the largest and takes care of 70% of our dental needs, Medicare Advantage Plan, Atrio Health Plan, and the county-sponsored mental health organization, Behavioral Care Network.
Is the risk shared relatively evenly by the owners?
Risk is shared exactly. Each have 1/11th there. So, key partners in terms of providers, listed those in the chart there. And in addition to our key partners who are already mentioned as owners or on our board, there's another three dental care organizations, the Salem Kaiser Transit District and TripLink, for which we started non-emergent medical transportation last summer. We have a decentralized model for administration, and three different administrative service contracts help provide our medical management, case management, customer service, finance, accounting, all through Mid-Valley IPA, which is doing business as the Willamette Valley Health Authority. PH Tech, a local company, does our claims and encounter data for us and several other health plans and CCOs in the state. Mid-Valley Behavioral Care does our mental health and behavioral health administration. They were once part of a five-county consortium. Now they are run by Marion and Polk counties here. MedImpact is a national company that helps do our pharmacy benefit management, and we use various public and private providers for substance use disorders. In terms of risk sharing, we've taken steps to implement, we believe, the targets for alternative payment methodologies. The big takeaways I would take is that the biggest one is that we have prepaid global risk model that mirrors the OHA's global budget. And that is for medical, physical, mental, and dental health. We now have two hospital systems that have their own primary care physicians and have global risk incentives to control costs. And I won't quite use the Vice President Biden's words, but this is a big deal to have hospitals that have risk and have employed physicians who now have an incentive to control hospital costs in a way that's different from what they used to have.
Are they subcapitated?
They are. They're fully subcapitated.
Great.
97% of our enrollees are in primary care homes. Other tools we use for alternative payment systems include withholds, risk pool sharing, sharing of pharmacy risk, primary care funding, access payments, payments for acuity. The quality incentive metrics model, we've tried to have it so it will maximize the work of the providers. One flaw, I would say, in how the state does quality incentive metrics is that it pays the same amount for every metric, regardless of the potential savings for that metric or the cost to achieve that metric. And so we have weighted our metrics to look into consideration the potential savings and the cost to do it. So it, one metric to follow up on mental health discharges may touch 170 people, but a SBIRT survey to check and see whether a enrollee has a potential addiction issue may touch thousands, 10,000 or 20,000 folks. And so those are not matched. So we try to weight those so that the monies will be able to go for those who are doing the work for those metrics. Going on the slide for enrollment, we've had a tripling of our enrollment over the last 10 years, had a 60% increase since December of 2013, just before the expansion. And it's amazing as I look at this and other communities that we are able to absorb another 40 to 45,000 enrollees in a single year. In order to accommodate that, adjustments had to be made. Our local independent physician association partner had to add special clinics to accommodate the expansion. The use of mid-level providers have very much expanded over the last couple years. Just to give you a feel for the ratios here, one major physician group has 182 primary care physicians, has 72 mid-level providers working there. And the same group with 331 specialists has 146 mid-level providers there. So one of the goals I recall from hearing Governor Kitzhaber was that everybody work at the top of their license in order to maximize. So you're starting to see this happening here. Recruiting of providers continues to be a challenge. Shortages in our area, locally, endocrinologist, neurology, pain management, consulting of the non-interventional variety, rheumatology, and pediatric specialists are still a challenge. Many of our members have to travel up to Portland in order to have those services there. The chart nature of the delivery system. Again, I described the number of providers we have, 285 PCPs and 74 clinics. 477 specialists and mid-level providers in our largest partner that has 80% of our enrollees. They are seeing, just to give you some comparative numbers, 3.3 primary care visits per member per year. To give you a feel for access, 1.1, the chart says 1.2, it's 1.1 specialty visits per member per year. ER visits, half a visit per member per year. And when you reduce those ER visits related to chemical dependency and mental health, or those that turned into an admission, that drops down to 0.42, and that's a pretty good number there. Mental health visits, 1.7 visits per member per year, included the last page of your detailed narrative. You can see where those numbers came from the state and compare with the other plans in the state. We have four dental care providers, as I mentioned, organizations, 11 substance use disorder providers, contract with three home health agencies, 28 durable medical equipment vendors, and Salem Kaiser for non-emergent medical transportation. In regard to school-based health care, this is a new effort rolling out in our area, and that's being supported by West Valley Hospital in Polk County. And they're having an open house this month. And early description that it's going to be a well-designed program. There had been a similar effort, I understand, before I came here that is no longer operating in the Salem side. So this is what I know here, and we will try to work as close as we can with them. In regard to Learning Hub, there's been lots of movement and positives in this area. We have a strong relationship with the Early Learning Hub. I serve on their board, and their executive director serves on our board, so there's some good cross-governance there. We provide in-kind support to them through office space, human resource, accounting, and IT functions. We've attempted to align our metrics around developmental screening and well-child visits, and there are mutual and emerging work highlighted on the slide that be glad to talk about later if you have more questions. You know, some of the things we can share now, the ages and stages questionnaire is an important thing. It can be done in the field with pediatricians, and then it can now be shared much more easy than it could be before. So those are just things that just facilitate important work here. The CCOs really are in a good, if not the best, position to help those in the age 0 to 3 category. And so as we look at trauma-informed care, and we see that a child that is not getting a good start, does not have developmental screening, and therefore doesn't do well, doesn't read by age 3, and therefore doesn't graduate from high school, is not able to get good employment, gets depressed, has other...
read by the third grade.
Third grade level, thank you. Read at their proper level by third grade. When you don't hit those benchmarks, and then you just start this cycle where you start to self-medicate, addictions, other things. And these are good early steps to try to move earlier down in the process here to try to get good preventive actions taking place. In terms of flexible services, we would we're admittedly taking a cautious approach here. We're probably spending less than other plans. We spend about $34,000 To date, we've had 148 requests, of which 119 met criteria. I've been told that we were the first one to actually buy an air conditioner, although I haven't confirmed that. That was told to me just recently.
Not
here.
Not apocryphal anymore.
We're learning what we can do and what we can't do. We know that we can't pay everybody's rent. We can't fix all societal ills, but we can work within the new rules to be more efficient and effective. And I think our staff is getting used to figuring out how to do these. And sometimes I see invoices. We bought shoes for somebody. We bought an apartment for somebody who just had a baby and has nowhere to go. So those kinds of things are being used. I see us buying a crib. Sometimes a crib was rejected for somebody. The mother was very concerned about a baby aspirating, and it was viewed initially as simply as a convenience, but the non-traditional healthcare workers we have working were able to work through the process with the medical management folks to say this is a need. Sometimes something as simple as helping a mother get a child in and out of a bathtub so the child's not dropped and slippery and those kinds of things. So I do see creative things being done there. I think there's much more that can and will be done. In the case of our community advisory council, we have monthly meetings. Our bylaws only required quarterly, but we have done monthly meetings. Times and locations have been adjusted to meet members' needs and availability. Sometimes we'll have noon meetings, sometimes later in the evening, sometimes downtown, sometimes in our office to accommodate particularly those community members that is more of a challenge for them to come. We provide stipends to them to assist with child care if they need it. We've sent out invitations and tried to have four different community meetings last year in Salem, Woodburn, Dallas, and Staten. One of the meetings had as much as 100, some 25. One had five. And the one that had five, I said, you know, how many invitations did we send out? And we sent out to 2,000 households. Oof. You know, so the efforts there and just being able to get participants is what we have not been able to do. Our community advisory council has been properly interested in the many facets of CCO operation and of the nature and composition of our members. I've included in one of the charts in the detail. You'll see there's a calendar of things that they've asked for to see. I think that's good. They've asked for reports on demographics, grievances, access, prenatal care, tobacco, obesity, depression, consumer surveys, transformation grants, and that helps them in their primary focus, which is responsibility for the community, for the CHIP, the Community Health Improvement Plan, and to make sure we're doing our job. Revenue and expenses and profitability. Our goal is to maximize service and value provided to our members, to maintain a healthy, viable network, maintain access. Our target is about 1 to 3% of net income. You'll see that for the last 2 years, as a percent of total capitation, 1.5% in 2013, 3.4% in 2014. And if you subtract out the monies that are pass-throughs, the money that actually drops down to us, 1.8% 2013, 3.8% in 2014. And we did a little better than budget last year due to non-emergent medical transportation was lower than in the first year, and the ACA expansion group you mentioned, Representative Lively, was lower and has been lower for many plans. The second chart shows our revenues and expenses on a per-member per-month basis. We've had no distribution to owners. Our net worth of $22 million is equal to 5% of our 2014 capitation and equal to 3.4% of the first 2 years of revenues received the last 2 years. Changing the way healthcare is delivered, we've introduced global capitation concepts. The hospital changes I told you about, inclusion of hospitals and risk sharing, case rates for some specialties for methadone and pain services, leveraging quality and centric monies to really drive performance rather than the old way of visits and volumes, removing administrative barriers and such. I think as I'm running out of time, I'll leave you time for questions. There's charts there on the way healthcare is financed. There's more.
We're doing fine.
Huh?
We're doing fine.
Okay. So changing the way healthcare is financed, you'll see a summary, a one-page chart there. You'll see lots of changes from the old fee-for-service to capitation and risk-sharing and case rates and methodologies for rewarding quality. Behaviorists, we have 75% of our enrollees they receive primary care from clinics that have an embedded behaviorist and assisting primary care, and that has lots of advantages for us here, lots of helps. The primary care doctors really appreciate that. The next challenge will be getting enough providers that can to do medication management and prescribing providers in the mental health side. So we're getting more seen and assessed, and we need more in that area there. When will results be evident? I think we're already seeing many results. Metrics are being met. PCH enrollment is in the mid-90s. ER utilization is down. There's a higher self-reporting of overall health as being excellent or very good by our members. Transformation projects are on schedule. Cross-governance with the Early Learning Hub and financial models that the with the OHA global budget methodology. The question will be, how much change can the provider community accept? When people ask me, how is Obamacare doing? How is state health reform doing? I tell them the medical community is stretched right now. It's stressed. And we are asking people to do a lot of things without paying them any more money than they did in the past. And most of these they accept. There are some that they reject, and we'll talk about that in a second. Specific efforts that are underway to integrate physical and mental health. We have embedded behaviorists, as I mentioned. We have an embedded provider, primary care provider in one of our mental health chemical dependency providers. We've talked about Early Learning Hub. We've co-located the behavioral health administrative staff in our building to be closer to us. That facilitates lots of integration discussions, weekly care management meetings, integrating mental health data into our reporting databases. A dental van that's scheduled at the behavioral health consumer-run organization, and other efforts like that you can read about. Implementing the opioid pharmacy guidelines, working closely with the mental health folks, and we've just adopted those guidelines recently. Improvement quality metrics, you'll see three slides there. The next three slides show four each, and in each of these, you'll see a comparison of the 2011 baseline with our performance in 2013 and 2014. And I think you'll see good trends that are there. We have a foundation that's being built through our electronic health records for population health management. This chart shows 80% have electronic medical record adoption. It's probably over 90% easily, because the only ones the state counts are those who received monies from the feds for either their Medicaid or Medicare. So we have higher adoption than that slide would show. You see an improvement again on ESPRT. We're still trying to improve there, employing various strategies to operationalize this effort with different strong measures there. Adolescent well care, one we struggle with. I think our providers question whether it's evidence-based or not. We'll talk about that in a minute. On the last page of quality improved metrics, that shows follow-up after mental health hospitalization. Difficult metric to get. We missed it by four. Very frustrating. It's potential $800,000 for missing four. And sometimes someone comes on our plan and they are discharged the day they came on our plan. And timing is tough. And sometimes they don't want to return a call or they don't want follow-up. So some of that is not in our hand, is within our scope there. Next chart shows the incentive metrics results for 2014, the preliminary results. We've met almost all of them, with the exception of the mental health hospitalization one that I mentioned. I think one of note is the emergency department utilization. We expected that to worsen with the addition of 45,000 enrollees. That's the 60% increase that we had there. And, in fact, we met that, and one of our staff members told me, he says, we're killing it in regard to how well we're doing. So that, I think, is impressive. That shows that people are getting enough access and not having to run to the emergency room there. So efforts such as our peer support programs help to reduce unnecessary hospital utilization. You asked about the measures in which we struggled. There were two we did not meet in 2013, adolescent well care visits and follow-up for children with prescribed ADHD medication. And then a third one would be the lowest one we scored on, was the MH hospitalization there. And in the case of adolescent well-child visits, again, there's a question from our providers, is this the best use of their resources in a system that's stressed out right now? This requires a 45-minute visit with an adolescent who often has maybe had a sports physical, as other things that they want to do. It is not the standard of care in the commercial insurance industry, and so it's one sometimes that I can tell our providers, even knowing they may get incentive money, may have other priorities and say, I would rather talk about other health care issues than this particular issue. So barriers there, we've listed the adolescents themselves and barriers from the providers questioning the practicality and efficacy of these incentive measures. What's the CCO done in response there? Targeted member outreach, distributing member-level reports, identifying which children have not received this care, gap analysis, and changing our incentive payment methodology to hopefully incentivize them to do that. The second one, poorly, was ADHD prescription barriers. Historically, we've exceeded here in the use of that. It's driven by community prescribing practices, exacerbated by what we describe as possibly loose CCO and pharmacy benefit management oversight there. Many physicians view the required office visit as an inappropriate use of resources, believe just a phone call would be enough to meet this. And the claims lag of 30 days or longer makes it hard sometimes for the CCO to track that. But we've tried to implement stricter prior authorization process, engage the community in discussions surrounding this area, and collaborate more with our mental health provider. Mental health hospitalization follow-up barriers. The target was 68.8%, and we finished at 66.2%. Okay, kept us awake for a bit, Dave. And tried to I wouldn't say strong-arm the regulators that oversee this, but they didn't count. So they didn't include preschool on the visit of day of discharge. We had five no-shows for that appointment, 7 with services within 7 days, but the codes didn't count. 11 with contacts more than 7 days after discharge. So that's close, but no cigar. And so our follow-up in that, our new staff will increase their involvement with discharge planning. We'll look to see if we can get clinical support from the mental health partner that we have. We'll set up a real-time tracking system and maybe bring outpatient providers into the hospital to try to meet that there. So, and results for 2014 show that we improved on the follow-up with attention deficit hyperdisorder prescriptions. We will meet that one, and as well as the adolescent well care visit. So,
okay, let's ask. Are there any questions? Well, I have a couple anyway. Well, first, I was interested in listening to you. Did you find putting this report together useful? Or was it
I think it's good. We don't celebrate success enough, and so it's good to look back, and you know, we're always focusing on what we're not doing yet or what we're not missing, and to go back and say, wow, look what happened over the last 2 to 3 years on the metrics and such. And so there's lots of positive change at a lower cost, at least a lower increased cost there. So with a lot more people, 45,000 more people have coverage. So that's a lot to celebrate.
My other question is, it is rumored before you got to the community that there was some strife, some internal warfare in this community. Has the CCO helped that? Have other things changed? It sounds like you have more harmony than...
Sure. I mean, I watched the headlines that were in the paper, and I was glad I was in Klamath Falls during that period. And so when I was asked to come here, I had read the papers, and I just asked, what's the current situation? And I was told it's in the rearview mirror, and I found that to be the case. I found a good cooperation. A good desire by the parties to meet the goals of reform and the triple aim, and I believe they're going in that direction.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair. Yes. Thank you. So I'd like to follow up a little bit, because you talked about the substantial increase in a very short period of time, but yet ER visits decline. So one of the assumptions I'm making in that is you have enough physicians or providers that you were able to rapidly assign them, or is there something else behind that change?
Representative Greenlick, Representative Lively, I think you have lots of things going on that are helping that. I think having better mental health coordination. I remember Bruce Goldberg saying, you know, we were worried when you cut the global increase from 5.4 we were used to for a decade to 3.4. He says, you're going to save this in better mental health management. And so, you know, we have a psychiatric crisis center right next on the hospital grounds that's being funded and through those monies there. And as you're able to do those things, as you're able to increase primary care access, as you're able to coordinate, as you're able to have the peer programs that are there, there's two peer programs. One is the MOMS program for mothers with addictions here. One is the EDIT program, which is peers on high utilizers of emergency room. You're able to just offset those, and I think you're seeing real results. In my mind, 7 data points make a trend, so we've got 3 years of data points, and we'll see whether this continues, but I think it looks promising.
Thank you.
Pupula?
Yeah, thank you. What can we do to better integrate physical and mental health, do you think?
There are two things. There are things you can do organizationally, and some of those we've done by having mental health providers on our board gives us a better window. By having mental health providers and consumers on the Community Advisory Council gives us a window. By the state putting a carrot or a stick for quality incentive measures related to behavioral health help us to do things that we weren't doing before. Most of them good, some of them maybe not evidence-based. The next big thing is to make sure we maximize the utilization of our dollars and look for best practices. You have a difference where you had some counties had as low as a 2% penetration rate for mental health, where I came from in Klamath County. You have the high mark of Lane County that has 12%. Penetration rate for mental health. You have statewide averages of about 6%, and Salem has about 6%. So, yeah, we need to look and see how our other plans should be more of, as we find with the information from the state, who is doing the best job, and make sure that through the Transformation Center and other areas that we take the best practice and try to replicate those in other parts of the state. So,
follow up, please. Who do you think is doing the best job in integrating mental and physical health among the 16 CCOs?
I have not had time to look at what the other 15 are doing. I look here at a lot of progress in Salem, mm-hmm. a lot of integration and discussion, the things I talked to you about, the co-locating of behavioralists, the co-locating of administration of the mental health entity with our entity. Those are improving meetings that weren't occurring before. So I think we're doing a much better job, and I see lots of good things on there. And the only other plan I've really looked at closely was Lane County, and they seem, again, they seem to have really been able to include the private providers in their group there. I heard another, the folks up in Portland, I heard when they testified, you talked about how important that the county systems are, and while you may want to tweak it and make some improvements, you have to be very careful because it is supporting a lot of other things there, and so it has to be thought out in a methodical way so that you don't damage a county mental health the department and all the other things that it supports for us. So, to answer your question.
Okay. Hey, well, thank you so much for driving over or sure, walking, sure. Whichever the case may be. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Would you please call the next witness?
Silas Halloran Steiner of Yamhill Community Care Organization.
I think the problem is the counties can't follow the tip.
No, we don't have to put you under oath because you're going to tell us these
there's
wild stories.
County Mental Health Institute.
I wasn't prepared to be put under oath. Chairman Greenlake, members of the committee, my name is Silas Halloran Steiner. I am the Health and Human Services Director in Yamhill County, and I'm here today in a capacity as a founding board member of Yamhill Community Care Organization and past president. And our CEO, Jim Carlo, is unavailable today, and I'm happy to be here and excited to talk about some of our accomplishments and answer your questions. Let me start just with a little bit about our community, because we've changed fairly dramatically in a short period of time, and I'm sure you've been hearing a lot of stories about transformation across the state. And in Yamhill in 2010, 2011, we really didn't have a dominant managed care organization plan. There was no single plan that had a majority of the interest of the business market. In fact, our largest plan had 2,800 members, and we had about four to 5,000 members who were actually involved in managed care. The remainder, 60%, were open card fee-for-service. So just imagine an environment where primary care access was very challenged and difficult, and many of the Oregon Health Plan members were seeking services in the emergency departments as a primary access point for care. So fast forward, we spent time 2011, 2012 reacting to the legislation that was passed here and the governor's health policy plan, the former governor's health policy plan, and our community chose to come together and talk about options. What are solutions? Where do we need to sit? You know, starting in the fall of 2011, really, we started holding some community forums. And this was largely the healthcare delivery system leadership. So you can imagine hospital executives and the Virginia Garcia, our largest federally qualified health center, and other, even the plans, the dental care organizations, the behavioral health folks, getting together 20, 25, sometimes 30 stakeholders. We had Bruce Goldberg out and Judy Moore Peterson from the health authority, and really we're trying to do some inventory. And so things came so fast. By March of 2012, the plan with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services was moving forward, and the talk was, well, do we sit as a community and watch another organization come in, or do we define something locally? And that's what we did. It was unanimous. It was a very powerful meeting. I remember at the McMinnville Fire Hall, I had everybody go around the room. I was facilitating this discussion, and everybody had the question, are you in, are you out, and what do you think, what do you want to do? And everybody unanimously said, I'm in, and let's make the best of what we can do, and let's see where the opportunities lie. So we organized a 501c3 nonprofit. We incorporated in August 2012 and built the board of directors that was largely the risk-accepting entities or the majority of the medical community that would bear risk in this community. We were very fortunate to have an infrastructure partner in Care Oregon make a $3.5 million investment in the community. Half a million of that was immediately put towards transformation, leveraged another half a million of local community dollars or in-kind dollars. So we were $1 million into transformation before the transformation plan and the fund was initiated, the $30 million that came through the legislative process. So we were very fortunate to start that way, and it's a little bit like I just got off the Rogue River, actually, five-day trip yesterday. Beautiful, wild and scenic section. And I was thinking about it as I drove down here from McMinnville. I feel like we hopped on a flood stage, high alpine river that was just rushing down the river. And there were obstacles everywhere, and there weren't eddies, and we weren't going to pull over and stop. We were full speed ahead. So luckily, our provider network stepped up. We had a lot of community advisory council members and clinical advisory panel members be involved in the early organization, helped us define our mission and vision. I do want to read our mission, or our vision. It's very aspirational. A unified, healthy community that celebrates physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, and social well-being. And then our mission is really working together to improve quality of life and health of our members by coordinating effective care. And I think that came out of the Community Advisory Council, and that was endorsed by the board. We've had a couple of opportunities since then to really continue to build organizational structure that were pretty significant, including we stepped forward and asked to become one of the early learning council hubs as well. So really our organization structure is the board supported by the clinical advisory panel, the community advisory council, and the early learning council hub. And I won't list all the members. I did provide in the testimony some of the key partners. We have two major hospital systems, Willamette Valley Health Center and Providence Newburgh Medical Center, and they really define some distinct health ecosystems. 60% of our membership feeds into that McMinnville Hospital area and the provider network that surrounds it, 40% the Newburgh area, and really that we have a lot of other rural incorporated cities and small communities that are part of that network. We have behavioral health providers, Virginia Garcia, the FQHC, and dental care represented on our board. And with that, we've stepped up to take the risk. So the community bears the global budget risk. the major infrastructure partner, Care Oregon, really does work on our behalf. So policy decisions are made and risk, financial risk is held at the CCO. We do have some delegated risk accepting entities, one of them being the County Health and Human Services. We do have some shared risk within that contract, but a majority of that downstream risk for the behavioral health, addictions, and mental health is delegated. And on the dental care side, there are three delegated entities, Advantage Capital and ODS or MODA. In terms of profitability, I know I want to get to all the questions that you've asked us to outline. In 2014, total assets were $25.9 million. Liabilities were $12.7 million. Total net assets, $13.2 million. And we had an operating income of $5.9 million in 2014. And to put some sort of numbers around minimum loss ratio, we are estimated to run at 87% in 2014 and in quarter one of 2015 running at 86%. So what we've been able to achieve in terms of opening up access and creating a pathway for now 25,000 members to have access to primary care and to begin that process of transforming a care model from no dominant health plan in 2010-11, 4,000 to 5,000 members assigned to primary care to now 25,000 plus is pretty fundamental in terms of the shift. So I think we're on the river still. We aren't rushing down at flood stage. We're maybe in a gorge looking around a little bit more and running some challenging rapids and being able to pull over every now and then.
And there may be a waterfall down.
there could be. And that's a little bit getting back to the money part of the equation. We're really working hard to build some secondary reserves. We've actually been establishing some pretty clear policy around how much secondary reserve and studying other small and mid-sized community health plans nationally to get an idea of where the benchmark should be. Because there are many people on the board, including me, that really want to make the public health investments. And we've got some pretty wise healthcare leaders who want to make sure that we hedge our bets a bit and plan for a rainy day. And so we're trying to really find that middle ground 2.5 years into the process of forming a new, what is now close to a $90 million annual budget of an organization that has a huge responsibility from a health standpoint in the community. So in terms of fundamental change, the main transformative work that I would highlight is work that providers and consumers have asked for. So we really try to listen to the members who are willing to lead change. And I could name example after example of that. One of the most recent was in the fall. We had a pain summit, and our public health officer, who's also an active practicing pediatrician and one of two county medical examiners, this is small community health. He really said, look, I'm going out and I'm doing medical examinations on young people dying heroin overdose and other prescription drug use. We need to have a summit. We had over 100 prescribers attend the summit across dental, behavioral, and physical, and really started the process of defining some community norms around opioid prescription. And we now have an interdisciplinary team that's looking at the morphine equivalent doses and how to move people into alternatives. We've opened an alternative pain clinic. We started this process over a year ago. We opened that up in April, and it's really providing a population from a community need standpoint that slipped through the cracks for years a new pathway towards a different kind of healthcare. So that's just one example, but the key is we're really looking at how do you make population health improvement? How do you look at clinical and quality improvement leading the way, not just financial incentives like utilization or unit cost reduction? So while those are important, I don't think that's going to be the end of the discussion, at least from a long-term sustainability standpoint. We have community health worker hubs for high-cost members who are accessing care. We have 10 over 10 patient-centered primary care homes. We've really worked with the community in terms of establishing from a provider standpoint what are those comprehensive care team-based care models and what do they want and how do we want to organize and set some standards around that. Our payment models are shifting away from fee-for-service into value-based purchasing. It's an evolution. We now have over 75% of our network in three dominant primary care provider entities, Physicians Medical Center, Providence Health Plan, and Virginia Garcia that I mentioned. They essentially take over 75% of that primary care. healthcare access, and all of them are getting an additional per capita payment on top of any base payment because they're participating in the value-based plan that we've started down that pathway. In terms of metrics, we've met nearly 15 of the 17 financial metrics in 2013. We did very well considering that we were just starting out and a fledgling as an organization. And given that there was so little managed care penetration prior to the advent of our CCO, we feel like that's really moving us in the right direction. We anticipate hitting 100% or being eligible for 100% of the pay-for-performance in 2014. We're now taking that a step further, and each of the primary care practices who are accepting patients have certain benchmarks that they're holding themselves accountable to, and there's some transparency across clinics of what those measures are for access and quality, and they're getting to see that together and learn together and move forward in terms of changing the system of care. A lot of this is also trickling down to commercial lines of business or Medicare, because most of the clinics don't want to change, you know, their workflows for 20% or 30% or 40% of their business, depending on how much is the EMHealth CCO membership. So we're seeing some opportunities there. From a transparency standpoint, we do regular reporting of performance and financial at the board of directors meetings and through our finance committee. We've also been able to keep an annual report to the community that this will be our third year of doing in the fall. And we bring the community advisory panel, the clinical advisory panel, the community advisory council, the early learning council, now that we have one. We didn't have one at the beginning. And the board together for a four-way conversation in which we're looking at goals and our progress and measurement. We do a financial reporting at that meeting. And this year we have a aspirational goal to bring members. One person brings a member that they've worked with or that they've responded to within the year or been able to see their change in the community to that meeting. So we're really trying to reach out further into the membership and engage them through that process. That'll be next fall. In terms of integration overall with mental and behavioral health, I know that was one of the key questions. We have, like many other CCOs, placed behaviorists into primary care. We have four behaviorists out into primary care practice settings. We have two additional ones who are actually in our OBGYN clinics, so these are our prenatal care providers. And I'll talk a little bit more about it, but we're working on a maternal medical home model of care that'll be something that we really want to continue to invest in. We've also made sure to do bilateral integration, so we have primary care within our main behavioral health centers. So the county operates a community mental health program, and we've brought 3 days a week in now in partnership with Virginia Garcia. We have primary care on site. So we're really looking at, for the moderate and higher acuity patient population that are struggling with access or even within the kind of traditional primary care setting that we're asking people to attend, when they're really getting intensive services or might get other supportive housing and other wraparound supports, we're trying to get that home established through our main center in McMinnville, and we've had really good response from the population that we're serving. People are enjoying it. People want to. Some people are even asking for it to switch from another care provider. We've also got in Newburgh a similar thing happening where Virginia Garcia has co-located within a health center where we've got public health and behavioral health, kids, adults, addictions, and WIC, women, infant, children, operating all within one location. From an administration standpoint, we have severely decreased the reliance on another old mental health organization called Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network. They've been a wonderful partner through this process of transforming, but in January 2015, the county took over a delegated risk contract to manage more of the local clinical care decisions within the community and keep decision-making local and keep some of the opportunities for building administrative structure with the CCO right in our backyard. We're still relying on some technical assistance from that organization, and we've been really fortunate to have a board member stay on our board from that organization. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there to improve quality and to really define as a system as we integrate going forward what some of that change needs to look like, and we're right in the middle of rolling up our sleeves and doing that now. Let me touch on the maternal medical home model a little bit more. So we are hoping to pay for care differently for prenatal care in a bundled payment and to make sure that care coordination and behaviorists and really thinking about new moms who are high risk and families who are high risk, thinking about their psychosocial barriers to getting health care, whether or not they're coming in for the first visit or whether or not they're continuing with all their prenatal care plan. And we're hoping to have some really strong outreach in partnership with Public Health runs a maternity case management model of care where we can do home visits even prenatal before delivery. And we've already had some really great success stories, from operating that program for years. It's not like it's a new model. But what we're really looking at is defining some core benchmarks, much like a patient-centered primary care home model of care has some really core components as to how you meet that quality. We're defining that locally, and our providers are at the table saying, this is how we want to define a maternal medical home, and we're working with the state. And I think it will be something that's pretty exciting if we want to share that work out with the rest of the state as we work along that path. The Early Learning Hub, we've got a lot of different projects going on. One of the best things that's come out of this is that our community is actually having conversations about the nexus between health and education and the value and really thinking about together we have some collective impact framework that we can operate under, and that if we can align our resources better and define and measure our success against some clear objectives, that we're all going to benefit. And I think that all seven superintendents from all seven districts are either at the table themselves or they've designated someone to participate in this work. We got some kindergarten innovation grant funds to do vision and dental screenings in the summertime. We're doing some almost like readiness for kindergarten and readiness for first grade in some districts. They've chosen that where parents are getting education along with their children about what to expect and how to show up just before school starts, and nutrition and the dental and vision screenings. We've got some, much like a community health worker hub to make a referral, we're trying to build a strong pathway, and we're going to do a pilot just in McMinnville first, where the schools can refer out when they see healthcare needs being unmet, and either that person will get connected back to their primary care that's already established and will remove the barrier, whatever it might be, or we'll make sure that they are aligned with the primary care, patient-centered primary care home, or in some cases help them establish if they're eligible for the Oregon Health Plan but not signed up. So the schools have said, these are some of the needs we have. We don't have social workers in our schools. We don't have time for this. We got teachers driving kids to a dental appointment because if they don't get this abscess fixed, they can't learn. Help us. And the CCO is really trying to be a backbone organization to meet some of those needs. From a community transformation standpoint, I mentioned the Fall Forum. We're also planning a family resiliency conference in the fall to really look at childhood trauma and start to get our business and faith and other community sectors involved in community solutions around how do we leverage, from a village model standpoint, the resource that exists here. How do we help strengthen high-risk families? It's not all going to be about medical care. It's certainly not all going to be about the education system. And we know that childhood trauma, whether it's in utero, prenatal, or whether it's in that first 36 months of life, has a huge impact to long-term health. And it's one of the solutions we're looking at is really making that investment in prenatal to first 36 months of life. So we got to do some community education around that, and we've got some speakers coming and a plan for that. Well, we're actually working with Tony Bigland to do a comprehensive health and wellness initiative where we would actually evaluate our existing infrastructure on prevention wellness and where the return on investment lies, and then make some of those key strategic decisions as we talk about, okay, we've met our secondary reserves, now we have this community benefit to make, and where do we want to invest. Our measures that we did not perform to the highest potential, the three were the emergency department utilization. We were at 58.9 per 1,000 members, benchmarks 44.6. This is 2013 now. Also related to that was our consumer assessment of healthcare providers and systems scoring, which was only 81% of the members felt they had appropriate access to care. I won't go into great detail on this one because I want to leave some time for questions, but we are taking steps. A lot of it is primary care access and then member engagement. We have the CAC has put together a member 101 member engagement education process that we're rolling out as well. Adolescent well child was another one. We are already seeing improvement again. To me, the most important thing is which way are we trending on these? We're trying to build some standards of care in around this one so that it's more routine within the primary care settings. And the last one is the ESPRT, the screening, brief intervention, refer for treatment for substance abuse. And we have already moved that back up to the five. We're over the 4.7% improvement target now. We were at a very low 1.7%. One of the things we're doing, though, is not just thinking about engaging people to addictions care with the primary care provider. We have certified recovery mentors that we've invested in the community that are actually out trying to engage people, whether it's at a church meeting or a faith or a social service or someplace they're getting a meal or a 12-step meeting. And we're really trying to do peer-to-peer interventions to bring them to care and improve that penetration rate for addiction services. We have another peer-based program called the Responsible Moms Program that we've invested in as well. Same idea, let's try to take high-risk pregnant moms who might be afraid of losing their child and get her some care if she wants help, and we want to get her addictions care and have her have a healthy baby and keep the baby. And that message is easier done through a peer with lived experience than through a government leader or a healthcare professional that they never make it to. So I think I'll just end that really we are standing united. There is a lot of community buy-in. Norms are changing. Culture, perception, the stigma associated with the Oregon Health Plan. I mean, I had somebody tell a story the other day about a care provider who it was a nurse or a care coordinator in a physician clinic trying to get somebody into specialty care. And when she said to the other person, this person's Yamhill CCO, they made room in the space, in the schedule and put the person in. And the comment was that never would have happened 3-4 years ago with the Oregon Health Plan. Just there wasn't a sense of ownership. And in this case, it's more like, oh, yep, they're one of ours. We need to do this. Let's make space. Let's care for this person. So we're really looking forward to continued stewardship of these public funds, making wise community health improvement choices, and making sure that high-quality health care is at the center of the conversation that we're having locally.
Great. Questions?
Chair Greenlick, thank you for your presentation. One of the biggest challenges with organizations that start at a smaller level of funding because of your patient base and grow rapidly, one of the challenges, I believe, is getting the appropriate level of care to the patients and trying to meet as many of the matrix as possible while keeping up with the administrative mandates that come to you that you have to provide back to the OHA in order to comply with your contract. Do you have any examples of efficiencies, one or two examples of efficiencies from your perspective, whether it's duplication of auditing or that kind of thing? Anything specific that you could say that we might work on as those contracts come to you to continue that might make it more efficient?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I think one of the things we all hope we can do is just slow down a little bit. I listened to the last testimony, and Jeff Hetherington mentioned the contracts review process that we weren't afforded this last year. I think certainly we need to move ahead a bit so that we're able to look at things together. And I think there is a high desire for the Oregon Health Authority to be collaborative, and there's many of those leaders that are working really hard to get it right. So with some time, if we set that as a goal to make sure that we have an adequate contract review, I think that's one concrete thing I would mention. And I think just from a compliance and credentialing standpoint, having as much of the systems that they can build at the Oregon Health Authority to create the banks, the credentialing banks like they have set forward and started down that path, will help some of the efficiencies just from an administrative standpoint within the 16 different CCOs, because there's no need for four different CCOs in a region that's sharing some member population or people travel, or maybe they have some of the same provider networks. There's no need for the providers to have to do that four different ways or for the CCOs to have to monitor it in the exact same way, creating that duplication. So those are two things I can think of.
Follow up. So you're probably aware that there's negotiations going on right now in your contracts, and there is an amendment coming forth that would be a 60-day contract review rather than a 60-day, 90-day, and 135-day. Do you feel like the 60-day would be – certainly must be an improvement over the 4 days you had prior over the Christmas holiday, over New Year's, Christmas and New Year's. But do you feel that 60 days would be an appropriate amount of time?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I would defer to my colleagues who are really charged with running the health plans as a board member, I don't think it's probably best for me to comment on is 60 enough. I know 60 is a whole lot better than 4, and I would agree with that statement.
That's fair enough.
Commissioner Lively?
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. So you talked about we opened up and saw a pain clinic or potentially other. I'm just trying to understand since the CCO is a nonprofit standalone. Mm-hmm. So in opening up, is this through providing incentives so some other provider provides that, or how does that work?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, it's a great question, and I was not clear. It actually is being operated through the CCO, and we have a leased space that is about 7,500 square feet, about 5,000 of which is dedicated to office space right now, and the other 2,500 square feet is for the wellness center. And it may spin off at some point, but as we analyze the ability of any single provider to step forward and create that organization versus bring it under the umbrella of the organization of the CCO, we made the decision to start it this way. But it's very much under discussion at the board level about what's the best model. And one of the hopes is that this will be accessible for other populations. We already have a lot of providers saying, well, when can I send my other populations, Medicare and you know, commercially insured as well. But I should note that we've had other partners from the local hospitals. Providence put some physical therapist resource into it. We've worked with George Fox University for the behaviorist that's doing that, leading that activity. So it's very much a collaborative. It's just we did need a space and a place to do payroll and a badge to give someone under the Yamhill CCO title.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you a question that you may find hard to answer honestly, but let me try and ask you to do the best you can. I've been observing the work that's been going on here for all along, and I've been very impressed with it. And I think a key issue has been your involvement in it. I've been curious as to whether the effectiveness of your involvement has been simply a matter of your own charisma. I mean, and I mean that seriously, as a local person who can get stuff, or is it because you were the Health and Human Services Director of the county? Was it the official role that you played that helped generate quite an extraordinary action in the first year or so?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, this is a difficult question. And, you know,
important question, because as we go forward, I mean, should we be saying we need to get the county officials very much involved?
Yeah. Well, so I honestly don't believe that there is anything that I, as an individual, have done that is outside of what any other person could do in a community around this kind of community leadership. And I believe that our community was primed for change, and the right circumstance happened that people stepped forward and took the opportunity and really ran with it. So I would give credit to the people who have worked hard at every level of our organization and down in the trenches, and the people that are really, I mean, we had physicians come in on Saturdays just to help write the initial application for the actual certification of the organization. But I do think that there is a role for local government, and that there is a role for public health and publicly funded behavioral health and the local safety net system to step forward and to be part of a solution. In many ways, that has been a backbone for poor and vulnerable and underinsured populations for many, many decades. And counties put resources into that, and communities already have certain pathways, some stronger than others and some with their challenges. But if we can get past some of the relationship challenges that exist, especially in small communities, and help people that want to lead step forward and do that together, then I think there's all kinds of opportunities for improvement across the state. And I, you know, I listened to a question earlier, and I'll sort of answer it here, which is, what do we need to do better to integrate these models? I think we need to go slow and study them with data, look at the outcomes we're wanting to get, and make policy decisions that are really more evidence-informed, more research-informed, more outside consultant-informed than politically informed solely, and really try to step into that space as we go forward.
Well, that's why we're holding these hearings. I mean, we believe this, as I said in the letter, is a hypothesis that we can actually change the way healthcare is produced in this country. And we want to make sure we're doing whatever we can to facilitate the strong points and maybe to tamp down the 3 points across the 16 different plans. And while when you look at 16 plans, you're looking at 16 plans, I have a sense we're all getting some sense of this movement. We have four more. Hear from, is that right?
Three, Mr. Chair. Three more.
Three more to hear from, and we hope we can all draw some conclusions, but I think looking at what we're doing is a very important issue.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may.
You may.
Because I know you did put Silas on the spot to toot his own horn and everything, but I think, and Silas, you can back me up on this, but I think before the CCO even began in Yamhill County, or especially McMinnville and Newburgh, there was already kind of a community that was working for this, you know, to reach out to people that needed help. We had churches with community kitchens, lots of different things that were going on. And I think with Yamhill County making its own CCO, there are a lot of people just waiting, how do I do this, how do I do it, and jump into work. And Silas was fortunate to jump in, and he is the right guy to facilitate this and make it happen. And it was the whole community being involved is what happened. And I don't know if you have anything you want to add to it, but on the outside looking in and just working with a lot of different churches and seeing what was going out, there was a lot of community involvement on the outset.
A comment? You don't have to.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I mean, I think that probably the next...
Are you his constituent? Does he have to listen?
I sure am.
It depends upon where he lives in McMinnville. So.
I think that really from a public health standpoint, Oregon has a unique opportunity right now with health system transformation, and I believe deeply in the opportunity. And I think that there's a lot of people in our community that have a passion for this and that put their hearts into it. And when you work with people and you share that, that's pretty contagious. And so, you know, I really look forward to making the investments in the youngest populations, our prenatal, the really upstream social determinants of health, and leveraging faith community and other social service providers and people that want to do right by their community, the business sector. I mean, there really is an opportunity to get far from medical care to think about health while we still really put medical care as a central pillar, and how do we make sure that that's happening high quality and there's good access.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your presentation, and I do think that you've been one of the really innovative models. I think your background in behavioral health and bringing that at the very beginning of the CCO was instrumental. And you always speak about the things that are really, you know, dear to my heart, public health. And I know that Representative Greenlick's public health modernization bill will dovetail very much with the kinds of population-based strategies you've talked about. Your focus on maternal and child health, particularly prenatal, and the importance of that, and connecting to the early learning hubs, you know, is music to my ears. But the question I would have then is, when you talk about the school-age population, one of the things that we struggle with is not enough funding for nurses in the schools, mm-hmm. whether it's through the school nurse program or through school-based health clinics. And we're among the worst in the country in terms of the ratio. I think it's 1 to 750 or so. So I wonder if you have at all thought about using your CCO money to actually put a nurse in every school. And, you know, with the hope of proving how important this is to the overall health outcomes and moving our state more in that direction.
Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, we, to my knowledge, there are many things going on that I don't know about, have not, as a CCO, thought about outstationing CCO-funded nurses into schools. We have been working strategically to place behavioral health specialists into schools, and we've done that in most of the more rural settings pretty effectively, and we're doing that more and more. So the only school districts in Yamhill County where we don't have a strong presence inside the school is in McMinnville and Newburgh, our largest mm-hmm. cities. In all the other districts, we actually have a partnership where we do take health plan funds mm-hmm. out to the school, and leverage a contract with the school where they pay for a portion of that activity for IEPs and school-related admin and the crisis intervention in the principal's office where they just need somebody to come in and talk with the parents or to sit with the kid for a half hour. None of that is funded through medical necessity, what we traditionally think of as healthcare dollars through the CCO. But the other portion that we actually meet with and develop an assessment and a service plan and then work with that young person on their depression, anxiety, behavioral challenges, whatever it might be, in a school setting where they're not necessarily needing to travel. These are folks that have plenty of challenges from Amity or from West Valley, Sheridan, Willamina to a clinic that's not in their community. The stigma associated with that, I mean, there's so many barriers. So we're really trying to break down that barrier, but it's been largely focused around behavioral health access, not necessarily nursing, you know, medical care. And while we do have a history of running a couple of different school-based health centers, both through public health and through medical sponsors in the community, there are challenges around economies of scale with school-based health center models. And then how do you really think about where is the healthcare home? And these are conversations I have all the time with, you know, the leaders, policy leaders around how far can we go with school-based health center models? Where do we need to take that? And how do you get at what you're talking about, which is really providing good access to health and decreasing a barrier right there in that young person's life.
Thank you.
One more. Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate your work.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I think he's really interested in the healthcare system because he likes to eat at roadside taco stands with Jameson and I. So.
That sounds good.
Roadside taco stands, yeah. A big part of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We have Friday. What do we have Friday?
Just two, Mr. Chair.
Two plans on Friday.
Yes, and we start at 1. It'll be Eastern Oregon and Cascade Health.
And then the following Wednesday, we have one left.
One left, and then we have Lynn Saxton coming to bring in OHA's discussion and the CCO stuff.
Reaction to them.
Yes.
Okay. We are adjourned.
Pretty impressive presentation.
Yeah. I assume we're still here.
Pretty impressive presentation.
Yeah. I assume we're still here.